kautta me haleja, ui kui hule kaleja.
Welcome to the California Indian Radio Project. This program is Ahashimam Nation, the first people of San Juan Capistrano.
Before the founding of the mission in San Juan Capistrano, the ancestors came out of what is now the Los Nietos or Whittier area, out of Los Angeles, out of the village site of Cejat, came and founded the village of Ahashimam. And Ahashimam is where we're at now.
The Ahashimam were greatly impacted by the missions, and over the years found ways to preserve their cultural identity and survive this very, very severe plan on the part of the Spanish to Hispanicize and Christianize Indian people in Southern California.
I remember discussing with my father the beauty of the mission and the architecture, and he would nod his head. J.C. would say, yes, that was correct. And a very nice garden. I said, yeah. And he would nod. He's very agreeable, my father was. And then he said, but son, the missions are a giant tombstone to our race.
The voices of Ahashimam and Luceño tribal members of San Juan Capistrano talking about their history. Since the founding of the mission at San Juan Capistrano in 1776, they've been known as Juaneño, but they call themselves the Ahashimai. I'm Neil Harvey. Their story is one of many layers and strata. First, they live peacefully in the villages of Cejat, Petutum, and Ahashima. Then the Spanish came and built the mission over their villages. Next came the Mexican rule during the Rancho days, and finally the Americans came to stay. Today you'll find these native people living totally surrounded by some of the most affluent cities in Southern California, including Dana Point and San Clemente. This tiny community, a mixture of Santa Fe and Malibu, is more famous for the mission and its birds, the tenacious little swallows, than it is for its indigenous roots. But the native people of San Juan Capistrano have never left, and they're making a big comeback. They are organized and determined to reclaim their aboriginal rights. They want people to know of their history in the part of town known as Los Rios, and that their ancestors built the mission San Juan Capistrano. On this program, producer Peggy Berryhill introduces us to the Ahashimam Nation of San Juan Capistrano.
Some of the groups that had the first contacts were the Kumeyaay in the San Diego area, who are also known and know themselves to some extent as the Geño.
Dr. Susan Lobo is a cultural anthropologist. She explains the first Indian-Spanish contacts in Southern California.
The Ahashimam have known themselves also as Juaneño from San Juan Capistrano area. The Chumash people, who are in the north and near Santa Barbara. And there are many other important tribes in that Southern California area who were greatly impacted by the missions, and over the years found ways to both preserve their cultural identity, preserve the most precious core of their cultures, while attempting to survive and sometimes flourish in the face of this very, very severe plan on the part of the Spanish to Hispanicize and Christianize Indian people in Southern California.
First of all, we perhaps numbered as many as 10,000. I understand that that's a high figure. It probably is nearly accurate. At least it gives a good idea of how many we were. My name is Frank P. Lobo, and I'm a member of the Ahashimam group of people of Southern California from the town of San Juan Capistrano, which we used to call Ahashimar. And we call ourselves the Ahashimam. We occupied a small territory, about 50 miles square. One side of the territory was adjacent to the sea for a distance of 45 miles or so. And the other, the eastern part of the territory, was a ridge of coastal mountains We lived in small extended family groups of perhaps as high as 50 people altogether, totally independent from each other. Although we were tied in by marriage ties, we had an extreme form of exogamy, that is, out marriage. There may be as many as two or three extended families at the most in a village, probably all related. So we had to marry outside, and we had very close economic and political ties outside with other groups of people. For instance, the people at Ahashamai, that is, of San Juan Capistrano, had very close ties with the San Luisenos at Pala and Pauma and those places like that, to the south. We spoke a very similar language. There was a bit of chiding. We had a lot of games, and the games became rather hot at times. At least we didn't have any warfare. But we did have games, and they became the focus of intertribal relationships in some cases. And we also had peon games as well that went along with these tribal clan gatherings. We made extensive uses of the seacoast resources. Even though we had a permanent village in one site, we had hunting camps up in the highlands of the ridge that I mentioned, the eastern ridge of the mountains. We depended greatly on acorn, with acorn leaching. We also made extensive use of food plants, root crops. As a result, there was a great deal of moving about. And the resources were owned by the women, usually, the plant resources, that is. I think it's a fairly accurate picture of what it was like before the Spanish came.
I think that many of the terms that are frequently used, such as hunters and gatherers or people who are migrational people, give a connotation that paints a picture that's very different than what was really happening. It paints a picture of people who are kind of aimlessly wandering here and there, who don't have a plan, who don't really relate in an intimate, long-term way to their natural environment. And this wasn't the case. There was very extensive planning that went in on a seasonal basis as to how the world at large was utilized in a balanced way. There was not agriculture in terms of planted crops that were then irrigated. However, there's ample evidence that efforts were made to see that plants were nurtured. A kind of horticultural effort took place to shepherd the environment in the best possible way so that the abundance that was there could continue.
Joyce Stansfield Perry and her family have lived in San Juan Capistrano for generations. She works to preserve the history and promote the traditional culture of her people. On this program, she helps tell the story of the Ahashimem Nation.
We know from oral histories that our people were very aware of the changes that were taking place around them.
Some of our people refer to as a Spanish wave of terror when they came. There are stories amongst the people of sighting ships offshore. And the Spanish ships. And the Spanish were quite active. The Manila Galleon, for instance, cruised these shores for almost 200 years, maybe even more. And shortly after, Vizcaíno came through in the early 1500s. We're aware there was something happening out there, and we're also aware there was something happening down south in what is now called northern Mexico. And the Spanish didn't reach us until Daanza and Bortola came through. And finally, permanent settlements established in 1776, and the Mission San Juan Capistrano.
I sometimes imagine life at the village sites of Patutum or Hahashima 400 years ago. Traders and artists from areas up and down the state came several times a year exchanging stories and material goods.
There was whole groups of traders and also musicians. The musicians and the traders had carte blanche. They could go any place they wanted to go. All others had to go through a lot of ceremonial exchange and introductions and recommendations and from everyone concerned. But the reason the traders were given a carte blanche was that they carried strategic materials. They would move materials from one side to another. And I give you an example. For instance, the Indian people sometimes suffered from goiters, and they traded for medicine. And I quote, medicine, unquote, was really oysters and clams, dried seafood, dried shellfish. And the dried shellfish has iodine in it. And iodine is prophylactic for goiters. So it wasn't considered food, it's considered medicine. Enough of seafood of any sort, dried seafood, including fish, including the seaweed, all of which was food. It was considered in between food medicine or medicine food. As a result, traders were very important. There was trade of wood from the eastern sides of their territory into the west. There was a trade of obsidian from the north to the south. The trading of deerskin from the west to the east. And all these were strategic materials, things that people actually needed. It wasn't seen as a luxury, it was a definite need. And now the musicians had sacred songs. The musicians cured. And if you were hostile to the musicians who carried the sacred chants and the sacred curing songs, you were out on a limb. That was the end of that group. You had to either disperse, you had to leave your territory, you had whole families had to leave. Traders and musicians had tremendous reputations too. Reputations just followed them hundreds of miles inland, up north, down south. They were the equivalent of modern day celebrities. Plus they had this aura of sacredness about them.
The Indians were used as slave labor to build the missions and create the military outposts. The modus operandi of the Spanish coming into California was such that a military contingency, along with a very few priests, would come into an area and carry out what they called a reduction of Indian people. This, in a sense, was going out and encircling villages and bringing the people in, either enticing the people in with goods or capturing them and bringing them in, reducing them, as it was called, into an area where a mission was going to be built. There's a fair amount of documentation about the many Indian people who did rebel, who burned missions, escaped, returned home to their communities. But as the Spanish moved north, especially along the coast, 100, 150 miles from the coast inland, this area particularly was strongly dominated by the Spanish mission effort. And as time elapsed, the missions reached out further and further into the inland areas to find more and more Indian people to work at the missions and take care of mission activities. The death rate in the missions was extremely high. Many, many contagious diseases swept through the mission quarters and killed men, women, and children very, very rapidly, so that the 1770s to the 1790s, this was a period of a great deal of population decline.
Many people wonder how the Spanish were able to subdue our ancestors so quickly. It's not that there wasn't some resistance and uprising against the Spanish, but our people were grappling with so many changes to their daily lives, and the widespread disease and starvation was taking a toll on our ancestors. These crises compelled our leaders to look to the men in the gray robes in a very practical way. Some of our people went to the Padres to learn about their power and instead found themselves baptized.
The church really took the major role. They dealt directly with the Indians, and their idea was to quickly gather together these people living in free villages, practicing a hunting and collecting economy, and bring them into a central labor site, teach them new technologies and skills, and hopefully introduce Spanish language and Catholicism as a way to control them.
Ed Castillo, professor of Native American Studies at Sonoma State University, co-author of Indians, Franciscans, and Spanish Colonization, The Impact of the Mission System on the California Indians.
The control was accomplished really quite easily because Indians, it's not clear they ever understood this. Once they allowed themselves to be baptized, and you have to understand they were being baptized because there were these new diseases sweeping through their community. People were afraid. The shaman could not help there, or the Indian doctors were not capable of dealing with the new diseases, measles, mumps, chickenpox, syphilis, smallpox, diphtheria, tuberculosis. All of those things did not exist here. And as a consequence, the parents are terrified. They'll seek any assistance. The padre says, I can help. Let me baptize the children. Say one child out of a village of 20 survives. You can bet those parents feel they owed that child's life to that padre. And then these are very traditional Indian feelings. Somebody does something for you, you must do something for them. They say, Padre, what can I do for you? Oh, allow me to baptize you as well. Once the families were brought into the mission, they took the children away from their parents. They locked them up in barracks. Little girls especially were locked in barracks. It was called moñeros, and kept there until they married. about the age of 15, 16. So by taking children systematically away from them, they ensured that the Indians would labor and would not run away, even though many of them did run away, about 10% during the mission period, able to escape.
Steve O'Neill, an ethnohistoric researcher, offers this explanation for the ability of the Spanish to convert so many Indians within a few years.
Many of the leaders would go in to learn from the priests, because obviously the priests were the shamans of this new society, to learn about their religion. The Catholic priests would then take this as an opportunity to start training, teaching, and convince people to listen to our beliefs. Someone would go through the training, and they had to go through what's called a catechism, and that would be several weeks worth of training, and then they would have to ask, do you agree to be baptized after this training? And only then could they baptize them. What the Indians didn't understand, the baptism was free will, but at that point you were also under the civil control of the priest at the mission at which you had been baptized. And you had to stay there, follow their rules, and you couldn't leave except with parole. Well, I'm sure that came as a rude shock to them when a week or so later they wanted to go visit their family in some other place, and they were told, no, you can't. Sometimes it was very gradual. One family got trapped. Well, the chief's not going to get all of his people together to fight and maybe risk losing five people just because three of his people can't visit as much. Now, let's say over a 5, 10, 15-year period, hundreds of people have been baptized at this point. Very soon, villages start becoming depopulated, and you start losing the social cohesion of the village and the clan. So when the priests go back out and say, well, how many other people want to be baptized, you might get 15, 20 people at a time at that point and bring them into the system. And over the slow accretion of people, the whole society can get kind of sucked in.
Indian people reacted in a number of different ways to save themselves and, when possible, save their communities and save as much of the culture as possible. But it was under extreme duress. The effort, as visioned by the priests and the military, was to create these communities around a mission. And they were modeled very much after rural Spanish communities with an emphasis on agricultural pursuits and other crafts and artisan activities. So there was a training component, there was a religious component, and there was a community building component as envisioned by the Spanish. And all of this was very much, of course, against the traditional ways of Native people in California at that time.
The Spanish purposely located missions on sites of religious or cultural importance to the Native inhabitants. The first attempt to establish the mission San Juan Capistrano was in 1775 at the village of Juanes Sahavit. The attempt was aborted because the Spanish had to return to San Diego, where our Kumeyaay cousins had staged a revolt, killing a priest and burning the mission San Diego. The Spanish suppressed the revolt. 1 year later, they reestablished the mission San Juan Capistrano at its present site, which is our village of Ahashima.
We're in the front of the mission, which opened up onto the plaza, the main part of town. And if you want to go left,
David Ballardis,
is the barracks building, which extended out.
While
into
some
the main
people
plaza
in California trace their history back to the founding of the state, we can trace our families back to before the Spanish arrived. Our chairman, David Ballardis, is one of those people. He was raised in the town of San Juan Capistrano by a father who was born in 1885. For the past two decades, David has been involved in many aspects of cultural preservation for our tribe and knows our tribe's history very well.
David Ballardis, and I'm the current tribal chair of the Juaneño Band of Mission Indians of Ahashima Nation. I have seven generations in the city of San Juan Capistrano and descend from the Native population and the first expedition, 1769. I have some old Yorba maps I acquired here that were drawn up in the 1930s. They were showing the town and where the people lived in the different adobes. In the southern part of town, down by San Juan Creek, there was a Temescal, which was the sweat lodge. So 1870s, 100 years plus after missionization and Catholicism, we're still practicing our traditions and our culture. The book Chini Chinish on our God and Prophet, that was recorded by Geronimo Boscana, who was a priest here in about 1812 to about 1824. For 12 years he was here. Our people were 40, 50, what, 60 years into missionization, and he records this whole incredible amount of our traditions and culture in this book. And it's published in the 1840s and republished in the 1930s. And it's the only ethnographic study of the Mission Indians. You know, and it covers boys and girls' puberty rites, different ceremonies, the Eagle Ceremony covers that. What's amazing to me is that the religious leaders at that time even gave him this information.
For all the Spanish efforts at Christianization, the Hohoshiman have maintained their cultural identity and traditions.
Because we're dealing with a patriarchal culture in the Spanish culture, they only would recognize the men. They were the actual workers. Well, the women stayed at home, much like Spanish women stayed at home. They didn't work. And the women were at home still practicing, in essence, the old ways. They were still gathering. They were still digging up roots. They were still gathering acorns. They were still teaching their children their language and so on. And all the components of the culture were still left or not overtly suppressed by the Spanish missionaries. So you see those complexities, even within the conquest. So here you had women being the conservative bank account of the tribal group. While the men were going the other way, they were seeking power, the power of the Spanish. They were out there learning how to build boats and building missions, even though they were our tombstones. And they went out there herding cattle, so they're learning about that aspect. They're learning about European architecture and European agriculture and tanning hides and making bricks for the missions and learning how to cut stone. And they were acquiring their form of a yelque with the Spanish, where the women were out here, they're still maintaining the old traditional conservative ways because they were at home. Because that's the way the Spanish would like it. That's what they wanted. They wanted the native women to behave just like Spanish women. And they wanted the men to behave just like Spanish. Well, the way things happened, that's what occurred. But the paradox is that the women were the cultural conservatives, which was an interesting situation, wasn't it?
Ed Castillo talks about why tribes like the Hohoshiman survived.
They have a wonderful long-time tradition of staying together as best they can. You know, what used to happen in crises in traditional society is when resources got scarce, drought or something like that, the people would sort of spread themselves out over the landscape a little bit more, scatter. In other words, they'd scatter. And when things got better, they would come back together again. And I see this process, this pattern in our lives today. Some of the people from San Juan moved many, many miles away. Now things are getting better, the community's coming back together again. And this is a human adaptation, and it's a survival technique. It's something that rather than being looking at it with dismay, we should look at it and say, hey, these are pretty resilient people. And they're a good representative of many other Indian communities that are in the same position.
Sitting in the backyard of a home that has been passed down for generations, David Ballardis talked about the future of our people. The tribe is seeking to be fairly recognized. If we achieve recognition, we will be able to gain greater control over our destiny and no longer be landless Indians. We've been petitioning for federal recognition for the last 17 years and presently are on ready status, waiting for the Bureau of Indian Affairs to move us up to active consideration.
I just listened to a few of our elders the other day. As finally, their concept of it was the U.S. government finally recognizing them as human beings, as people, as a nation. I think that was it for them. Anything beyond that, they didn't care. Just that satisfaction that they could go to their grave knowing that the U.S. government, after all it's done to our people, had finally said, yeah, we recognize you. You now, in our eyes, exist. I think they want that gratification. For a lot of our people, they don't care. They don't need the U.S. government to tell them who they are or to be recognized by them. That we know who we are and that we will always be who we are and we will always be a nation. So we have, you know, the differing points of view. I think the majority want that recognition. They want something for their children and their grandchildren, something for the future.
In March of 1997, the Hohoshimen were on the ready list for recognition. But our near success has not brought on the unity we desired. It seems like it has brought out some of the worst in human nature. Some people seek recognition as identity. Some see economic development. And for others, it means a grab at raw power. The drive for federal recognition has caused a rift in the tribe, and in the summer of 1997, headlines in the Los Angeles Times and Orange County Register declared a war against our movement to gain federal recognition because local residents fear the tribe will develop a casino. It is true that investors have approached the tribe to urge them to build a casino, but the momentum to hold off investors is growing. One of our elders, Ruthie Lobo, offered these thoughts on the role of a casino.
Within the last 30 years, we have come from a sleepy little town to looking at men on the moon, from hiding in the bamboo because they've seen an airplane go overhead, to now. I think in maybe 40 or 50, 60 years, I think they're going to be in Star Trek. They're going to be jumping around from galaxy to galaxy. And to make a decision that big right now, I think it takes a lot of thought, you know, because I don't think that casino money is going to bring us out with any kind of dignity. I really don't. Good money, good hard-working money is won by sweat, not by standing at a 21 table. I just don't think so.
We don't know how our quest for federal recognition will turn out or how we will become economically strong. But I do hope the next time you visit the village of Hohoshima, San Juan Capistrano, and look at the surrounding hills and valleys, or visit the ocean, you will hear and feel our ancestors' presence. Outma, I'm Joyce Stanfield Perry.
Hohoshimen Nation, the first people of San Juan Capistrano. This program was written and produced by Peggy Berryhill, with assistance from Joyce Stanfield Perry. Series Executive Director, Peggy Berryhill. Project Director, Roby Cook. Production Assistants, Julia Sinagini and Susan Rushmeyer. Narration by Joyce Stanfield Perry. Digital Editing and Mixing, Neil Harvey. Thanks to Leroy Miranda Jr. for Gord Rattle Sounds. The music of Koljadimo appears in our theme. This program is a project of Northern California Cultural Communications, with funds provided by the California Council for the Humanities, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Lannan Foundation, the Leff Foundation, the Vanguard Public Foundation, the Abelard Foundation, and the Seventh Generation Fund. For the California Indian Radio Project, I'm Neil Harvey.
To order a cassette tape of this program or a resource guide with more information about the people and topics we've covered, call 1-800-461-3991. That's 1-800-461-3991. Or visit our website at flickerfeather.org.
This program is distributed by the American Indian Radio on satellite, a service of Native American Public Telecommunications.